Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
And I'm Paul Riesmandel.
And on this week's program, we're turning our attention to industrial music. Not the noisy music genre, but music played in industrial settings for workers, including Muzak. Our guest, Alex Huey, is Associate Professor of History at Mississippi State University and has been studying all sorts of things surrounding music, including the history of industrial music systems. Alex, thanks for joining us on Radio Survivor.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So I saw you present a paper recently at the Society for Cinema and Media Studies conference that was on the topic of industrial music systems. And you talk about how some of these systems were used for worker morale. And your research really resonated with me because I vividly remember working at a temp job in the 1980s, and they piped in music, which I thought was Muzak, may not have been Muzak, but it was piped into the shared workspace. And to me, it was very intrusive and distracting because I kept focusing on the music and wondering what the different sound, what the different songs were that were playing, because I could largely identify them. So I was really fascinated to learn that these industrial music systems weren't necessarily designed for the purpose like I received it, that they were perhaps, you know, supposed to help with productivity and morale, and that the outcome that I had, the response I had, was probably not typical. So I was fascinated to learn about this much longer history. So I thought maybe, you know, we could just start by having you talk about what industrial music systems are in the first place.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, I think you can, I mean, I'm sure this audience, it's not new that the music has been a part of working, right? For since working was invented, I guess. But we can think about the beginning of the 20th century as the first time in which music is not seen as kind of a break from work. And a sort of relief that happens during breaks or before work or after work, or as like a way to promote a company by like sponsoring a marching band that, you know, parades up and down during the, you know, the town's like summer festival or something. And it's really with the introduction of recorded sound and the ability to play music without humans, you know, making music with their bodies, that music starts to accompany labor rather than, you know, sort of exist as a break from it. And there's slippage, right? I mean, there's certainly work songs, you know, that are used to maintain rhythm or to communicate. But the application of this music to usually the factory setting to increase efficiency, to reduce injury, to reduce tardiness. So there we can already see the beginnings of trying to kind of inform worker morale. That you can probably date to the 20s or so, 1920s. And so certainly the use of the phonograph being played on the factory floor, and there's some like awesome photos that I found of the phonograph being used, not just in like a factory setting with humans working, but also in the dairy barns and playing in the chicken coops and, you know, trying to speed up the laying, I guess, or increase milk production. I suspect it actually was more about helping the workers in those settings relax, which then helped the animals relax. But
that's amazing to think about music being played to increase animal productivity. I love that.
Yeah. And I mean, and you sort of like, well, you wonder what kind of like music the cows like to listen to and things like that. Again, some of this I think was a bit performative. So there's the phonograph, of course. But then there's also, with the introduction of Muzak, the actual, you know, music amplification system, right, where it's electrically sent in by wires, and then there's an integrated speaker system that people could subscribe to, factories could subscribe to. And there's usually 3 to 4 channels that you would have different types of music that would be played on them. And once Muzak really got into the industrial music scene, they had a whole channel that was devoted specifically to industrial, like blue collar work, like factory work. They also had a channel that was devoted to white collar work. And it was supposed to help you focus rather than help you kind of align your body with the machinery of the blue collar work. And later there was actually the introduction of, maybe this would have been helpful in your situation, Jennifer, music to help distract you from like the tedium of your work. And it, and this one was very much a response to earlier surveys that were done of workers and trying to triangulate what their needs were and what management's needs were. And this was explicitly marketed as it will cut down on the chatter of the young women and will help them, you know, do their work, but not have, they don't need to focus on their work. They need to be distracted from like the tediousness of their work. And so the music was actually a way to kind of escape that space, which I find really fascinating. But Muzak wasn't the only main system. There was also an RCA Victor system. This one was a little bit different. It consisted of a subscription system for LPs for records, and then they would help fine-tune these records, the actual songs that would come to for these music directors, and every factory was supposed to have an RCA system, but it was essentially a public address system that was integrated with a phonograph player, and sometimes there were a couple, right, so you could switch between records. And they would, they had little guidance pamphlets for directors on how to think about programming and when to play music and what type of music to play at different times, and would help them, you know, again, do the refinements to the acoustics and all of that. So, and that one was a subscription system. And so they're a little bit different and they marketed themselves slightly different. They also aimed at different audiences. Some, I think RCA was in some ways aimed at both the management and the workers in their marketing, whereas Muzak was much more explicitly aimed at managers the whole time.
And I definitely want to get into more details about both of these systems, because I think there's a lot, you know, even in what you just described, that we need to kind of draw out. But I'd love to take one step back and talk just briefly about what drew you to studying this sort of, you know, music being played in factories and workplaces.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, again, this is part of a larger project, actually. I think you mentioned that I'm interested in looking at the history of the science of background music generally. And so I actually start with Edison and some early studies that he was doing in collaboration with a psychologist at the at Carnegie Mellon, what has become Carnegie Mellon. And looking at the mood effects of music. And I became especially interested in, they did this huge survey. They had these little pamphlets that you could fill out. And for Edison, it was like very much a marketing thing. And it allowed him to sort of burnish his sort of, the way that he sold himself as a great scientist and an inventor. And he, you would fill out this form, you would sort of say what the weather was like and what time of day it was like and what mood you were in, and then which of the Edison recordings you listened to and then how you felt afterwards. And then you would send this in, and they got like 20,000 of these. I mean, they actually got a huge amount of data. And what I love about this is that the practice of the argument that I make, and what I think is so wonderful about these documents, is that the practice of filling out this form, you are actually standardizing your own listening practices, right? And you're training these listeners, and this was, you know, maybe not explicit, but I think it was very implicit, and it was a goal of the Edison company. You're training these listeners to think of music as functional, and that music can affect your body, and it can affect your mood, it can affect your mind. And again, for Edison, this was a great way to sell records. For Walter Van Dyke Bingham, the psychologist that was studying all this, this was, I thought he was much more interested again in the mood effects and the psychology behind it. And this is the beginning, this is why I use this as the beginning of this whole project, of thinking of music as functional and the implications this has for us as individuals trying to shape our personal auditory environment, but then also when it starts being applied to other people. So this is where industrial music becomes, you know, very relevant, and the way in which managers are trying to, they're not always trying to manipulate. I mean, the cynical reading is they're trying to manipulate their workers, but morale, I think, was something that they also took very seriously, especially through the 1940s when they had to ramp up production so quickly. And there is this whole kind of military understanding of morale that's quite important and informing the way that they're thinking about their factories.
So
this
Alex,
goes on, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this notion that music affects your mood, that music can be used in part to set your mood, I think it's something which we take for granted, right, in the contemporary era.
Right.
And so what you're saying here is that there's evidence that maybe this was a novel way of thinking about music in the early 20th century, you know, which of course recorded music is a very new technology at the time. Prior to that, most music you would have heard would have been played by a human either in the home or in mm-hmm. public, right?
Right.
You're saying that in to an extent that this is the beginning of a reframing of music and in its functional sort of way that you suggest is different than maybe how people thought about music in the 19th century.
Yes, exactly. So there's certainly in the 19th century, there's an association between certain types of music, especially certain keys and certain forms of music and emotion, right? But here, the music is doing something to your body and changing it, right? And altering your experience of your own body. It's altering your mood. It can affect your decisions, right? There's a lot of, and it's not just music, right? It's also sound. There's a number of studies that happen, you know, in the wake of World War II, looking at the, you know, whether listening to fascist speeches over the radio can affect your behavior and your morals, right? And so there's this interest in the way in which, there's a new way of listening and there's a new understanding of the possibilities of what music and sound are capable of. And you're exactly right. This is something I think we take for granted and we think is universal and timeless, that, you know, the options in your Spotify menu to choose things based on your mood needs. And we do this now, right? I have music I listen to when I exercise and I have music I listen to when I need to write. And this has a history. It's historical. Just how we're hearing is itself, you know, shaped by time and place.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I could follow up, Jennifer, if you don't mind, you know, also, I think what strikes me about this is the notion, you know, we had researchers looking at this, a survey asking mm-hmm. people questions. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you know, I think it highlights how research is not neutral, right? And that mm-hmm. you're suggesting that in some ways they were reframing music for the people who took the survey. That, and indeed, it may be possible that the folks listening hadn't thought or conceived of music's role, utilitarian role, how it was affecting their moods. It maybe had not been conscious until they're actually asked to think about it.
Right. Exactly.
It's sort of self-reinforcing in a way, even though, you know, one might otherwise look at it as, oh, we're researching this phenomenon to discover about it. But to what extent are we maybe even invoking a phenomenon?
Exactly. No, it's absolutely a feedback loop that gets tighter and tighter. Right. And the surveys that are done of workers by Muzak or RCA for them to refine the playlist essentially that they're then marketing to the managers is, you know, the surveys themselves, some of them you complete a sentence or some of them are yes no questions, and the yes no questions are wonderful. I think I showed an example of this in that presentation I gave Jennifer, but it's for Muzak and it's these statements and you agree or disagree, and the statement is, you know, Muzak makes the time go faster, agree or disagree. Muzak makes my work more enjoyable, agree or disagree. The music I wish would end immediately. And so it's both, you know, marketing and reinforcing this kind of functional application of some form of music to the working setting. So, music becomes, let me back up, music works, right? It is a laborer in a sense. It gets integrated into the factory, not just the factory soundscape, but the factory scape at all as a laborer.
Yeah, I mean, in thinking about these studies, and I mean, it reminds me of studies that I did even in college as a psychology mm-hmm. major. I think we even did a project about, you know, does time fly when you're having fun, and, you know, having people watch or listen to something that we thought was fun, and does that make time go by more quickly? So the extension of all those projects. So I'm guessing that some of this research is what prompted companies to come up with these industrial systems, or to think about, hey, maybe we should be playing music all day for workers in the factory. Can you talk a bit about what prompted the creation of Muzak or of the RCA system?
Ooh, so I think they're slightly different stories. The Muzak system was invented. There's better histories of the sort of play-by-play of the development of the technology itself. The expansion of it in the 40s and 50s was an explicit expansion. There was a new CEO that just basically blasted it into as many different settings as possible. And so found that it was useful in like public waiting areas. So like lobbies of banks, lobbies of hotels, or, you know, this probably apocryphal story of playing it in a hotel and people would just come in off the street to like mill around in the lobby to listen to the music. And so it quickly expands in public spaces. And then in industrial settings, it was very clear there were a number of studies that were done in the 30s in Britain looking at increased efficiency of factories that had music playing. Now, they were actually quite careful this was studied very carefully. They often didn't play it continuously. So what you experienced was, I think some people would say, a misapplication of music in the work setting. They wanted it to energize the workers. I found this in several places, they recognized that the workers were stuck, right? You have no ear lids and they could not escape. And so they didn't want to irritate them with music continuously or music they didn't like. So this was part of the reason they were trying to get these response surveys and get a sense of what they actually wanted to listen to. But they found that it works better to just play for 30 minutes at a time. And, you know, just in the morning when everyone's coming in, and then maybe a mid-morning time along with announcements and that kind of thing. And then after lunch, they would play music, but you could never play a march after lunch because everyone would find that to be especially kind of like real drudgery. And and then another one, they saw, you know, productivity would decline rapidly right around this time of day, right? Like sort of like mid to late afternoon. And so that was another time to have a little 30-minute kind of injection of music. And they got very refined in what type of music should be played. It should be, you know, 2 to 3 minutes long, not a long intro. It needed to be, you know, sort of bright instrumentals that could cut through across the factory floor.
That's something I've been thinking about is that, so if factories were some of the maybe main places where you're hearing these sorts of music systems in the beginning, I would imagine those are very noisy spaces. So what is that like when you're trying to broadcast something over that?
Right. And that's something that the different companies marketed. So Muzak marketed themselves explicitly as, I mean, and it's a lot of kind of hand-waving acoustics, but they say, you know, that the frequency cuts through the factory sound, and that, you know, the way in which they design their speakers is especially effective for that. Now, this is a distinctively American thing. There's been some studies of industrial music in England and industrial music in Germany, and there's different priorities for whether or not the music should cover up the sounds of the factory or if it should work in concert with it. And I think the argument about the German setting, I think this was Karen Beisterfeld's work, but I'm going to feel bad if that's not who the author is. In the German setting, it was actually the sounds of the factory were supposed to be kind of celebrated and not muffled. And so the music is actually kind of supposed to be in concert with it rather than hiding it.
Which makes me like think about avant music genres and experimental music that incorporates noise. And, you know, mm-hmm. like at the beginning, I was sort of joking about we're doing an episode about industrial music. But not about Throbbing Gristle or, you know, industrial music bands. But yeah, that's probably an aside, but it does make you wonder if there were musicians who were inspired by that combination of industrial sounds with the music being piped into the factory.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and again, you know, these are triumphant sounds, the sounds of production and, you know, the sounds of modernity. These are not necessarily sounds that should be hidden away, right? They're to be celebrated. The music could be part of that. But not in the American setting. There, it was much more about giving workers the sense that the management cared about them and also manipulating their bodies and to increase productivity and reduce mistakes, essentially.
And I know there's kind of a parallel with radio as well, with the creation of some of these companies in the beginning, maybe even before they were piping in music to factories. And I feel like in the way you've described, especially the RCA system, that it seems like there are some parallels with radio stations. Like you mentioned that a plant might have a music director, that there's a subscription service where they're getting mm-hmm. records. Maybe talk about like how the parallels you see with radio and if some of these factories might even feel like a mini radio station at times.
I mean, there's certainly some of these factories had really well-developed programming, and they would have weekly quizzes, and they would have, you know, the employee of the week come in and accept a prize, and they running contests between different people, and people would come and perform, you know, for over the PA system. So, I mean, I'm sort of picturing it being a little bit like when I was in junior high, there was sort of constant stuff coming in over the PA system, and which I guess, you know, does boost morale, and everyone feels like they're part of a family, essentially. So I think that I don't know. Now I'm wondering if the music directors, I don't think that was a full-time position, but I think it was probably a task of someone in management, and this was again. You know, there were different systems. There were some where they could basically run themselves, and others, and certainly the Muzak system, right, doesn't require anyone. And because it's all getting piped in directly, but there's sort of varying degrees of involvement. And I imagine management would sort of make decisions about that, about depending on what their needs were.
Alex,
Paul, you mentioned
the Muzak. Yeah, I was going to, I believe, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it was actually also piped in via radio.
They tried that for a little while, yeah. And I think that they found, and I don't think they launched that until the 50s.
Okay. That's when the technology would have been available, yeah.
Yeah, but I think they really struggled, and I think they gave up on it because they were having trouble making inroads with it. They were also trying to expand into like personal homes and like domestic settings. And so they had a whole plan to do that. And I think that was especially going to be integrated with like a radio kind of broadcasting system. But they, at that point, they were running up against television as a competitor. And this is what they were saying in their internal memos, that they were kind of losing out on this market share. And it was just kind of too late to enter into those settings. I was going to come back to your point about, or your question about the looping that happens and the way in which, you know, there's this feedback loop of asking people to think about how they listen to music, and then this changes the way in which they think about how they listen to music. And because this is often background music and it's framed as background music and they're asked to pay attention to it and attend to it, it does interesting things to the background as well. And this is one of the threads that kind of weaves through this project as well, that, you know, by the 60s and 70s, it's like wall-to-wall sound, or it's possible, right, to have, you know, music playing at your home, on the bus, at your work, you know, at the restaurant, at the bar, and then, you know, on your way home again. And all of this can be highly controlled. And with that, I argue, this type of sound becomes naturalized, right? This becomes part of the human environment. And as a consequence, the environment itself becomes background, right? As other sounds become sort of attended to, the environment, whether it be a natural environment or a built environment, it still becomes backgrounded in a way that I think is new. And what I'm trying to get at, and this is, we were talking earlier a little bit about silence. I think the key to this is silence. And this is because this is the moment when silence becomes awkward. we don't know how to sit quietly with each other and be silent anymore. There always has to be music. And this happens right in this period. And it also becomes a technique for comedy, like the awkward silence. It becomes a concern in etiquette books. This is something I'm looking into right now, but I think this is a moment when we start to get really uncomfortable with just being quiet.
Well, and that, I mean, that makes me think of my example from the very beginning of being in this 1980s office setting. And in fact, it was a very empty office. I was one of the only people there. I think it was maybe salespeople had cubicles, but they were never there. And so perhaps they were piping in this music to cover up the fact that this office was just completely dead, like sort of
to hide the loneliness.
Yeah. I mean, this is very surreal, but it was being played at what I thought was a rather high volume. So then it felt like you were in a post-apocalyptic mall or something, with nobody around.
Well, and a lot of radio stations, a lot of radio genres advertise themselves as being for work. Right. So you've got more or less adult contemporary and its various sub variants now, because it's, split off 12 different ways, active adult contemporary or something, or the Jack FM or something like that, a light FM, et cetera, will actively advertise themselves on billboards, on television, and that, it's just the station everyone loves at work, right? And it's usually because it's reasonably upbeat music, pop hits of the last 20, 25, 30 years, right? And I don't know if I've heard this lately, but I remember maybe 10, 15 years ago hearing them also advertise themselves, and there's no, no hard rock and no rap, right? The two things on the spectrum that might, some people may be less into. I hope that's not still the advertising today in 2022. But I don't know if you've thought about that at all, Alex, and how in this continuum now that it becomes, as you've mentioned, music becoming naturalized to the background, that then you have other media, radio specifically, but more common consumer radio being advertised as well as your work accompaniment.
Yeah, I think, at some point it becomes this absolute cacophony, and the way in which you describe how radio is promoting itself is, the work is mostly done at that point, right? And people, of course I need to listen to music to do well at my job or to pay attention, and there's all these different ways, now there's all these different forms of music that you can choose from. I think what becomes really interesting is that people, again, Americans for the most part, aren't disturbed by this. It's interesting when I talk about this material in different settings, they find this deeply dystopian and problematic. And then others are just like, this is what I do to make sure I run farther when I'm exercising. And there is this moment where there is a concern about the authenticity of the affect that is being elicited. And, if it's the music that's making me happy, am I truly happy, right? And but that sort of flips away, and it doesn't seem to be a big concern anymore. And other outside of dystopian literature, right? And I find this really interesting too, that this people don't seem to find it threatening at all.
And, we've been talking about a little bit about the types of music and that maybe it's adult contemporary music now that might advertise itself as work music. I'm curious about, you talked about no marches after lunch, but what sorts of music was being serviced by Muzak and RCA? Like, what kind of music did they think at the time, like back in the 1940s? What was the kind of music that people wanted to hear while they were working in a factory?
It was a mix of different things. They had these lists that you could check off the music that you liked. And I remember seeing discussions saying lots of people want Hawaiian music, but we cannot play Hawaiian music because they will not do any work, right? But there was polka and popular music and gospel music, classical music, what we would call classical music. There was a repeated story that I don't know how frequently this happened or if everyone just repeated it, because I also think it's funny. They said, never, never, ever, ever play Deep in the Heart of Texas because everyone will stop what they're doing and clap along. And so, you know, there's sort of warnings like that. But it sounds like these kinds of traditional songs, maybe you would call that at the time, were also quite popular. Again, it needs to be upbeat. And now that I think about it, one of the surveys also collected some demographic information, not just, you know, what kind of labor do you do, but, you know, age and gender and national origin. They were actually collecting ethnic information surprisingly early. And then later in some of the internal discussion, they were saying, we can't play Wagner in the factory that is mostly Polish immigrants and, you know, things like that. So there did seem to be a recognition of that different populations had, different types of reactions to music, so that it wasn't universal and that they needed to be sensitive to different values. But that, again, was just a fleeting statement. So the larger impulse to me seems to be not only to using this more and more and trying to maximize the profit that would come out of it, but then also maximize the use of it. So ending up in the 1980s where it's playing all the time very loudly rather than, you know, for 30-minute chunks, you know, just to kind of re-energize the system.
And the, you know, with the RCA system, I think it's really fascinating that it was more localized, that you could have an on-site music director. And so I would imagine then from factory to factory, you would have a very different experience of the music you were hearing and the kind of programming. And so were they utilizing surveys that were very much based on that local, on that very location, so that an on-site music director could then tailor what they're doing and, you know, take requests maybe from the workers?
I mean, that's the implication that you have to kind of extrapolate from the historical record, right? So the stuff that's in the archives is these surveys, right? Not filled out, but just blank ones that they sort of distributed as samples to management. And then in some cases, when they would report on these emblematic cases in their monthly newsletter that they would distribute. So they would showcase certain factories were doing this thing and this other factory was doing this thing. The surveys, though, I mean, there's distinct differences between the RCA Victor surveys and the Muzak surveys. The RCA Victor surveys were much more open-ended. And so it would say, do you have any feedback for us? And tell us what you would like to listen to. And there was a thing called a request card, whereas the Muzak surveys tended to be either an engineer that worked for Muzak going to the factory and actually watching what people were doing, or these very narrow kinds of surveys where they would do the yes-no questions and that kind of thing. They could also say what type of music they liked, so they would do that. And here again, we see a kind of standardization of music typologies, right? And to think about, you know, of the different types of music that you can have in a working setting. There is polka, there is Hawaiian, there is, you know. And so here we have, yeah, again, training listeners and through the process of collecting data about them.
We are here on Radio Survivor talking to Alex Huey about industrial music systems that were utilized in the workplace. And you know, the way you're describing these surveys, there's a bit of a difference between the two systems that we've been discussing, RCA and Muzak. And if I recall, Muzak had a different goal than RCA Victor. Can you explain that again about how those two systems had different goals, which seems to really affect the reception of both systems as well?
Sure. Yeah, I think that, I mean, they weren't necessarily explicit goals, but I think the way in which they were framing their approach to both the technology and to the workers themselves led to different worker experiences of sound. The Muzak people, again, were, I think, partly because it was this arm of the organization was run by an engineer, they liked framing things in a way that they could count. And it seemed much more objective, like you can count the number of absentees, you know, you can count the number of people that are late, you can count the number of mistakes, you know, when there's like a thing that's being made and there's some flaw with it, or injuries. And they would chart, you know, these numbers against when Muzak was used and when Muzak wasn't used. Or they would chart it over the course of the day to see when, you know, production declined, or over the course of the week to see when production it declined, and then they would use that as to identify when they should be playing Muzak. And so it was a very kind of engineering oriented framework to the problem. Whereas RCA, from what I can tell from the archives, they are much more interested in worker feedback and using that to then develop the programming for the workers. And the fact that they give all this flexibility to the managers, again, allows the managers to respond to workers' needs and the needs of that specific factory. Now, a lot of this may have been a marketing ploy, right? I mean, this is how they distinguish themselves from each other. And Muzak talks a lot about psychoacoustics and the way in which their technology is specifically designed and highly precise for these settings, whereas the RCA Victor people tend to talk about worker morale and have real concerns about flexibility and not just workers being happy, but feeling like management listens to them and cares about them, and management also feeling like the workers are listening to them. And so there's this kind of again, this is based on evidence from the newsletters that they're distributing every month. So this is a particular way they want to frame themselves to their readers. So, but this is what we work with as historians, right? Trying to understand sound and kind of triangulate from these types of documents what the actual listening experience might have been.
You know, we keep talking about Muzak as in the past tense. But I don't think it is, actually, both sort of figuratively and literally, because I did look into it a little bit, and Muzak still exists, only it's yes. Now a company called Mood Music. Mm-hmm. And their tagline is, "We put people in the mood to buy." So I wanted to kind of use that as you know, so we have the sort of industrial application, but there's also, which you alluded to, sort of, there's also sort of a retail application, if you will, right? Because you mentioned, you know, being piped into sort of hotel lobbies, and people might come right in just to listen to music. And then, you know, I know of these examples of say Kmart radio, which the Internet Archive has, somebody has contributed hours and hours of tapes of Kmart radio, which is presented as if a radio station, but it's, you know, it's delivered, I guess, on cassettes or reel to reels with popular music. And then, of course, announcements, you know, for the stores, as well as maybe announcements of sales or something like that. You know, is what's the continuum there? I mean, obviously there must be some, I don't know, you know, how you've looked at kind of the integration then of these same ideas into the everyday, but still with the idea of moderating people's mood to buy, I guess.
Yes, so it's absolutely a continuum, and there's a lot of different players at work. So there's radio again, right? That is also advertising. You know, sort of enters radio as a way of supporting it. And so you also, some of these background music systems, like on public transit, will pay for themselves through advertising. So already the public is used to listening to music, but then also having advertisements coming through. I think that Muzak really starts to lose out its market share in the 70s and 80s with the rise of foreground music, which is music that is specifically branded to a company or a store. So this is when you get the beginning of a Kmart typology of music, or Starbucks and world music, if we all recall, right? Back in the 90s, that there was a sort of distinctive Starbucks sound, and this was all very carefully selected music. There's, I think, again, I don't have the names right at the front of my, the tip of my tongue. There, people have worked on this about Starbucks and world music. And so this foreground music that is explicitly associated with branding, it's to make the space welcoming to certain consumers, but not to others, right? And so we see lots of gender and race and class dynamics being played out here. And so this type of music and a number of companies that offered it tended to eat away at Muzak's market share, and eventually bought them at some point when they went bankrupt, when they filed for bankruptcy a decade, I think, or so ago. They got eaten up by one of these other companies. But so that's what they're now doing, I think, is sort of working in that realm. And but there's also, you know, satellite radio and all the streaming music, and there's all these different ways in which you have this kind of increasingly potentially branded music, or music that's specifically catered either by algorithm or by a human being that is designing it, you know, just for you or some sort of some. There's another thought I had about this that is like skittering away from me. Oh, the Internet Archive. And this, I encourage anybody to go find this. It's actually really fun. And you have to, the thing is though, if you're going to listen to it, you have to choose one tape and you have to listen to it for an entire month, because that's what those tapes were used for. The managers would get a new one each month, and they were supposed to destroy the old one and then play it. So like, it's all fun, you know, for like 12 minutes, you know, or maybe like a day, but you have to think of it if you're working in Kmart and that you have to listen to this for 30 days
straight. And it's just like a 90-minute tape, right? Or maybe 2 hours worth of tape, right? So a regular shift, you'd have to hear it four or more times. It actually reminds me, I worked in a small retail department store, regional chain in New Jersey in college, and they had like one freaking tape that played kind of like 50s and 60s oldies, but it was an hour and a half, and they played it over and over again, and I wanted to rip my ears off after. It did not contribute to my overall productivity in that environment. But thinking about music specifically, I mean, at some point, and certainly for my lifetime, music has a negative connotation, right? We don't like the brand name stops meaning is doesn't have a positive connotation, I think, to somebody who grew up in the 80s or 90s. It's the connotation of being, you know, saccharine or inoffensive, of not being, you know, you're not going to hear the Beatles. You're going to hear the Mantovani Strings version of the Beatles. Mm-hmm. You're going to hear, you know, the vocals taken out. It's going to be, you know, completely anodyne and stripped of any sort of unique qualities. Whether or not that continued to be true, I think that's sort of the popular connotation. And so I'm curious, is that really what it was for all this time? I guess, and at one point it was a radio genre called beautiful music, which would also play, you know, sort of pop hits, not by the original artists, you know, redone by Strings or Lawrence Welk or something. Is that conception, is that accurate? And if so, like, why?
I mean, I think your intuition is right. My understanding or my reading of all of this is that it got a little caught in time, right? I mean, right as it was trying to expand, but was also running up against a number of competitors, you get this rise of counterculture, right? And this reaction against the parent, you know, our parents' music and, you know, the Lawrence Welk and the like light music. And there's all these alternatives that are seemingly more authentic, right? And so it gets associated with an aesthetic, even though it's not that, right? It would claim it's a technology, and that it is its own. It was, for a long time, it had its own music recording and production arm. They would make their own music, right? And they would have composers that would write for them. And so they got sort of, yeah, they got associated with what is now considered sort of tacky, annoying music, right? Elevator music. And but in some ways, that's not entirely fair, right? Because that's not what they, you know, explicitly were trying to do. And it's not what they continued to do. They made all sorts of new music. And again, like you said, they still exist. It became kind of shorthand for music that we love to hate or we associate with waiting, right? Being stuck on hold or stuck in an elevator or stuck in a lobby. And so the music itself, right, seems to have gotten stuck in time. But I think it was also an inspiration for a lot of composers and musicians to react against it or to play with it, right? And so I'm thinking of like Devo. I think Devo, Mark Mothersbaugh tells this story about how they were playing this series of concerts and they found like one of the main venues was actually playing Muzak beforehand, before their concerts as everyone was filing in. So they started and they ended up re-recording one of their whole albums as like a Muzak version of it and of their own music. And it, you know, it becomes this kind of playful thing to kind of fiddle around with. And so you can still find some of those tracks, the Devo version or the Muzak version of Devo, if you're interested.
I think it's also interesting, you know, Paul was talking about, the stereotype that people of our generation have about Muzak and that there are no vocals, that's all instrumental. Was that the case in the factories where... were they playing music with vocals or was it all instrumental? Like, is that part of this legacy or not?
I don't think so. So that, then I think they still had songs. Yeah. That had vocals to them. I think now the reason the vocals are stripped out is because you can play the same song on a loop for longer. Like people won't notice that you're progressing through the song because they don't hear the stanzas and the chorus coming back again and that kind of thing.
Oh my God.
there's a lot. That if nothing else, right, my larger point, I mean, I'm a historian of science, right? I'm not just a straight cultural historian. And there's a lot of science and engineering and psychology behind all of this. This is highly refined and it's no accident, you know, any of these decisions. It's very carefully, you know, crafted.
Did you have access to these recordings? I mean, the RCA system or the Muzak system, were you able to find recordings and hear what was actually played?
So some of the older RCA stuff I've been able to find. The Muzak stuff is much more difficult to find because they are very protective of this material. I was actually in touch with the public relations, with someone there several years ago before their last bankruptcy filing and most recent acquisition. And, I think they're very nervous about their reputation given the sort of delicateness of it. And back when I talked to them, they had 16, 17 pallets of the original pressings and the masters and all sorts of internal documentation. And I was just like passed out on the floor with like delight as a historian. And, they were about to move from Seattle to North Carolina. And he was telling me, he's like, yeah, and we were going to destroy all this stuff because we don't need it. And I was like, And he said it was actually more expensive to destroy it than to move it back. So it's sitting in like outside of Charlotte in a warehouse. But I haven't been able to listen to any of that stuff directly. Mm. But there's more and more things like, you know, Internet Archive where people are slipping stuff in there. And you can find it. This is a technique I would say I've stolen from Emily Thompson of, you can find it in the background to movies and, uh-huh. you know, various films, like there's ways to find it existing, like truly in the background. And sometimes it gets played up for comedy. I mean, I'm thinking of like the Blues Brothers now. But there's also, you know, times where it just sort of exists and, it's little traces of these sounds.
I think in Repo Man, I remember vividly hearing, you know, like supermarket music. Mm-hmm. And it comes to the foreground when you're paying attention because it just creates the whole mood of, you know, of this sleepy supermarket at night and this, you know, sad music.
I go to a hipster supermarket where, you know, sometimes I go on a Monday afternoon and I hear Gang of Four. So, but, you know, I was thinking about the technological side. You talk about these pallets of tapes, and I know that to some extent there were proprietary technological formats. Like, you know, right. So on the one hand, like I know like these Kmart tapes we reference often came just on traditional cassettes or reel-to-reels, but often they wanted them in sort of systems. I think in part, I wonder if there's part of it was so that they could not be played by an unauthorized user. And then on the other side, because they were meant to be continuous, right? And so they wanted to be able to make sure that the system could be operated by, you know, any given worker and just sort of turn it on and it would just run and someone wouldn't have to attend to it.
So that you bring up an interesting juxtaposition, right? That it's standardized for ease of use and yet like is proprietary for, you know, business reasons, I suppose, and to maintain control over the music itself. And I think that's right. And I think that's ultimately probably the tension that undid them, right? And that there's still music systems around. I dork out when I like walk into my bank and I run up to the wall with this little speaker, which makes everyone nervous at the bank because I'm behaving very strangely. But they, you know, there's still places that have these integrated systems but they're defunct now, I think, at this point. Although one of the people said it wasn't that long ago that they stopped their subscription to it. So it may still be that it's being serviced.
By being serviced, they would be sort of live as broadcast or pre-recorded systems or both?
I think that they were pre-recorded systems, yeah. I assume, at this point. It was a Muzak system. I mean, you mm-hmm. on the dials and the speakers and everything. And it definitely wasn't live broadcast, but I'm not quite sure if it how algorithmic it was at that point.
I'm curious, Alex, kind of reflecting on all of this after digging into all the archives, do you have a sense of whether or not these systems achieved their goals? Like, did employee morale and efficiency improve?
Oh boy. I don't think we can know. I mean, on the one hand, it must have because people kept doing it. There was at least, it seemed, well, here's the thing, right? It either was effective enough that management was willing to invest in it. And some of these systems were not cheap, especially the RCA Victor ones were actually quite expensive. So you had to really believe in the science or have seen evidence that it worked. What is interesting is the idea of believing in the science, right? And here this goes back to this idea of thinking of music as functional and to be able to imagine that this system would work and then invest money and time and energy into it, right? That it seems so possible because of this functional understanding of music that you would then say, okay, we will spend the equivalent of like $12,000, you know, integrating this into a factory.
And then it reinforces itself, doesn't it? Because
exactly.
Once it becomes sort of omnipresent, then as you mentioned, you know, the awkwardness of silence, it then becomes like, well, our supermarket, our office, our bank, well, we're the weird ones by not having it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And if you're the only one that has these awkward silences, then no one's going to come to your store or your bank. And I'll note also, I was thinking about this earlier, that part of the reason part of the reason there's much more background music in the US and not in like, say, Europe, is because of worker rights, and that this is actually a labor issue of being annoyed, having to listen to the same 90 minutes over and over and over for, you know, an entire month. And that and the decibel level, right? So there's real restrictions on how loud the music can be. Apparently there's efforts to take care of that in the United States as well, but certainly abroad, you know, workers have been able to advocate for like the hearing damage that is occurring in loud workplaces.
Lawrence well, it makes Welk me is killing my hearing.
Exactly. I mean, it also makes me think about, you know, portable personal audio devices and, you know, does that now replace these factory-wide systems where, you know, it's so commonplace for people to listen to their own music while at work, you know, at home, working at home or working in the mm-hmm. office, you know, with their earbuds in.
Right. And so this is something that when I was first thinking of this project, I saw that as the obvious endpoint, as this kind of retreat back to like a personal individual listening experience. But I've decided it's still part of this continuum if for no other reason than because it's at this point, most people are listening algorithmically, right? They're listening through these like playlists that, I mean, some people still make their own playlists, right? But I think it's very few. It's not, you know, your Discman, make your own, you know, tape anymore. That existed briefly. But now, again, everyone's using streaming services, and these things are sort of, it's not very different from Muzak and the channels that Muzak would create.
And the streaming services all offer explicit workplace retail services so that they can purchase in part. We don't want to go down this rabbit hole because in fact there are performance rights that need to be paid that are bundled with the Muzak service or the RCA service. Those were all bundled up. And so then you can also get a Spotify or Pandora that takes care of those fees so that you don't have the BMI person knocking on your door asking you for back payments in addition to, you know, obviously paying for the service itself.
Right, exactly. So I think we're not so far away, you know, as much as we have, you know, again, the Muzak is associated with either a dystopian kind of listening paradigm or just a really tacky one. We are not very far from that at all. And in some ways we're listening in exactly the same way.
Alex Huey, it's been so great talking to you today about the history of these industrial music systems. And, you know, it definitely is making me think differently about factories and, you know, the soundscape that was taking place in the past while all of these workers were in the room and, you know, whether or not it was a system that was sort of thrust upon you from above or one where your factory had a little bit of control. I'm imagining the music director on site being kind of a sweet gig there, you know, and kind of like a little college radio station.
Well, it could be the most loved or most hated person, depending on, right?
Yeah, what music you chose for after lunch.
Yeah, and having the power to play what your workers want to hear. So I appreciate you kind of elucidating this interesting aspect of music history and audio history. And you've been listening to Radio Survivor. I'm Jennifer Waits here with Paul Rees-Mandel. And every week we talk about the world of radio and sound and dig into all these different corners of radio history.
Thank you so much for joining us, Alex.
Oh, thank you for having me. I enjoyed this very much.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Radio Survivor. You can see our show notes at radiosurvivor.com, where you can also subscribe to this show as a podcast. We're also carried on more than 24 community and college radio stations across North America and Ireland. Learn where you can find Radio Survivor on the radio dial, again, at radiosurvivor.com. If you have any comments about the program or any suggestions for things we might cover, you can drop us a line, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And finally, this is a listener and reader-supported enterprise. So if you want to learn more about that, you guessed it. You can learn more at radiosurvivor.com. Thanks again for spending an hour with us.